So with this little hat rack, let's begin first of all to look at some basic needs. The first need, and by far the most essential, is the need for security. Now, I would say that generally speaking, a person's security needs are best met in a healthy home situation. The most secure people in all of the world are people who are brought up in a home where there is a father and a mother incurably in love with each other, absolutely unashamed to express it. There is nothing that promotes personal security as much as this. And conversely, there is nothing more devastating than a child who never knows from one day to the next the status of his parents. They're always fighting. They're shouting at each other. Or they're not talking at all to each other except with sarcasm. And he learns to play one against the other in order to get his basic desires. Now, this fact of security is the major reason why we resist change. Because nothing is more threatening to the human organism than change. You will do anything but change. For change always introduces an element of insecurity. And this is highly threatening. We much prefer the status quo, which is well defined as the mess we're in. And the amazing thing to me is that the people who often talk the most about being secure, eternally secure in Jesus Christ, are the most insecure people in the present scene. And I'm convinced that this is the product of people who really do not know what true security in Jesus Christ is. And if you want to read the latter verses of Romans chapter 8, it's a good tonic for the soul. What shall separate us? Conclusion, absolutely nothing. And there is nothing as liberating as being emancipated in Jesus Christ. But the devil will constantly imprison you. And one of his favorite means is through a form of legalism. He's always putting you in the box. And the Lord is constantly trying to blow the sides out. For if the Son shall set you free, you shall be free indeed. I mean really free, Jesus said. Secondly, every person needs an element of stability. Now, we're going to see that each of these involves a balancing component. You don't want to be so secure that you're dead, that you're scarcely able to go out of the house or drive a car. Good night, I'm liable to have an accident. Yeah, you really are. You see, that's when you begin to border, as we shall see, on the neurotic. When you are constantly living in a threatened experience, insecurity. The same thing is true of stability. We are not talking about a person who is stable because he's set in concrete. Now, we've got too many of those in our churches. Well expressed at the beginning of the worship service, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. well describes the parishioners. True stability is a process of knowing oneself in relation to two persons, the person of God and the person of others. You derive your greatest stability by knowing that you are eternally related to Jesus Christ, who is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He never changes. You know, the one thing for which I worship God most frequently, I think, is His constancy. See, because most of us have a pretty roller coaster type of experience. We're like yo-yo. You know, up and down. And today, man, oh, light it. Tomorrow, Man, some people make this variation several times within an hour. And if you're married to them, you know, you're always doing this to find how's the wind blowing. Walk into the home, never sure whether your wife's going to take your head off with a club or with her arms hugging you, then that's highly threatening to a man. Secondly, your relationship to other people. And as we're going to see, the realization that you have something to contribute to these people. This makes for very solid stability. And both of these anchored in the Word of God. For although heaven and earth shall pass away, my word shall never. A third characteristic that everyone has, by which I mean you, is recognition. Nothing worse than being, what's her name? Sweetest sound in any language is to hear your name. If you want to blow a person's mind, just remember their name. You can be as homely as a mud fence. But you suddenly become the most significant person in this generation when you say, "Hi, Phyllis, how are you?" And usually you can almost register the reaction on their face. You know, how do you remember? And the interesting thing is, the reason why most of us do not remember more people's names is that we're really not that interested. We're usually interested in the impression we are making upon them rather than allowing them to make an impression upon us. Now, let me put a few things under this and share with you a book. This is the realization that you are an authentic person. That you are important to someone. One of the greatest books I think I have ever read is a book written by Dorothy Briggs entitled Your Child's Self-Esteem, The Key to His Life. I wish every girl in this room had a copy of this book. Purely secular. But it could make all of the difference in the world in the rearing of your children. Because the longer I am in this, the more I am convinced that the most important thing, single ingredient in a person's life is his self-image. And when Jesus Christ said you are to love your neighbor as yourself, he made a very remarkable statement. And if you hate yourself, girls, you will never love your neighbor. In fact, you will seldom love your husband. It is not until you begin to accept yourself and come to appreciate yourself that you are a hand, tool, specimen of the grace of God. And don't dump on him because he didn't make you like somebody else, because you wouldn't have been worth a dime if he had made you like somebody else. He made you just like you are. So stop hanging one on him in terms of why are you so short, or why are you so tall, or why aren't you more slim? I knew we'd hit somebody's needs here. Well, why is it that I have to be like that? You know, that does bug you at times, doesn't it? Down the snack shack, watch some of these guys open these lunches that you make. Man alive, how in the world do you girls ever stay on a budget? Boy, I sat down next to a guy the other day. I'm telling you, he opened it with almost a crate. And the sandwiches and the dishes and the pie and the rest of the stuff came coming out. And this joker ate this stuff till it was coming out his ears and said, "Man, my wife didn't pack me much today." And the guy's like a pencil. And I'm sitting across the thing and I'm just looking at it and it's coming on me. You know, and the interesting thing is you run into these people who are so bilious with respect to food and picky. And, man, I eat anything. And enjoy it to the hilt. And the biggest discipline of my life is to stay away from food. It's a constant problem. I still remember going through the hassle. Well, why did you make me this way? Well, I discovered one good reason. That's to keep me dependent on him. He says in the first chapter, there are two basic needs. Strong self-respect is based on two main convictions. Number one, I am lovable. One of my favorite questions to a woman who is having problems in her marriage is, do you think of yourself as lovable? And they blush and just about crawl under the rug. Oh. So do you think of yourself as sexually attractive? Oh, my. See, and I said, you know, this is really your major hang-up. See, I've been talking to your husband, and you should know what he thinks of you. See, all the time she can't think of herself as a lovable person. She can't love herself, therefore it's a real tough problem to accept the love of your husband. How can he love me when I know myself and don't like myself? Do your kids know that they're lovable? That's another favorite question I ask of women. Do you love your children?
Do I love my children? Of course I love my children.
Boy, that's wonderful to know. Do they ever get this message?
Oh, certainly.
How do they get this message? Well, I, you know, wash and iron their clothes, and I fix their meals, and I clean the house. How old's your child? Well, 4. Well, I bet that really comes through loud and clear. I am lovable. Second, and I am worthwhile. Now, if you want a little meditation to blow your mind, just stop and think of the contribution of Jesus Christ to these two concepts. Never occur to you that you were so lovable, you were so much the object of God's love, that if you were the only person on planet Earth, God would have sent Jesus Christ to die for you. How lovable can you get? While you were yet a sinner, Christ died for you. Worthwhile? Why, my friend, Jesus Christ rose from the dead, went back to heaven, and sent the Holy Spirit to live in you and to gift you And he wants to use you. You're the most significant person in this generation. And he doesn't waste his gifts. He gave you the very gift that best suited you and his needs. And I want you to listen to something, because a man by the name of Stanley Cooper Smith did a lot of research, and she quotes one of his studies. She says, his study, among others, indicates that this characteristic, that is high self-esteem, is not related to family wealth, education, geographical living area, social class, father's occupation, or always having mother at home. It comes instead from the quality of the relationships that exist between the child and those who play a significant role in his life. Recognition. Fourth, acceptance. That is the ability to accept yourself as you are. And the realization that this is the basis on which God accepts you, not a performance basis. But unconditional acceptance. Is the person who knows everything about you and yet completely accepts you. How can you afford not to accept yourself? Here's an interesting statement. Self-esteem is not based on the great things you've accomplished, the mark you've made, the things you own, nor is it canceled by your faults, failures, and sins. These acts reveal what you are, but do not indicate who you are and your divine origin. Self-love and self-approval are not the same. The true basis for a healthy self-love is to understand and accept the value God places on you. I can't think of anything more rewarding than communicating this to people who have been reared in a home where they have anything but security, stability, recognition, and the result is no self-acceptance. And that's your privilege. Fifth, satisfaction, fulfillment, achievement. Everyone needs this, and in some particular area. From a Christian point of view, this comes, I am convinced, from knowing that you are in the will of God. You're exactly where He wants you. And it's really what young people and adults are looking for. I just met a man who walked out of a $100,000 a year job to become involved with Campus Crusade for Christ, in which he has to go out and raise his support. And he's like a little kid with a fire engine. And last time I saw him, he said, "Boy, Hendrick, only got $40 to go." Here he is out asking other Christians to become involved in his ministry. He's about 46 years of age. Most promising future before him, walked out the front door, said, "Man, I've never been happier in my life." He said, "Would you believe it? My wife and I don't even have a television set." And he walked out of this fabulous home. They had entertained me about 5 or 6 years prior to this. I had never forgotten the experience. Just a lovely couple. The interesting thing is, and I just met the other night with about 10 medical doctors from this community. Interesting thing is, girls, the average business and professional man and woman in our society is screaming on the inside for satisfaction, fulfillment. How can I invest my life so that when I get down to the end of the line, it will have been worth it all? And that's the beauty of the ministry. If you are in the will of God, it is the life with no regrets. Now, let's look at some of what I have called the normal problem. One of the kinds of things you are going to face in counseling and for which you need to be prepared through some of the suggestions we are given. Well, let's take a minute to get just a little perspective. It was Carl Menninger who said many years ago, "We're all crazy. It's simply a matter of degree." That's really quite profound. Because if you set this up on a continuum, it will look something like this. Somewhere here in the middle is the breakover point. And on this side, you have normalcy. And on this side, you have that which is abnormal. And there is a great deal of variation in both areas. For example, there is a great deal of variation in normality between a person who is very outgoing and very aggressive and very talkative and a person who is very quiet and very reserved and doesn't talk a whole lot. And they are both within the realm of normalcy. What you are looking for in terms of symptoms are the changes between a person who ordinarily is very quiet and reserved but suddenly becomes incredibly talkative and very loud, or the person who ordinarily talks, you can hardly shut them off, and now they go into silence and they won't say anything. And you can hardly get them to grunt. On this side, we have a great deal of abnormality, and in between, you have this breakover, where you have what is often called the borderline. That is the person who seems to function ordinarily in the realm of the normal, but every now and then breaks over into the abnormal. Or the person who is really quite sick mentally, but on certain occasions you talk to them and they are really quite normal. I think I shared with some of you on previous occasions a girl who was married to one of our men here at the seminary when I was a student, who is so severely mentally ill that for the most part, she cannot keep a stitch of clothing on her body. She is always in an isolated cell. But she has periods of time in which she's just as normal as you are sitting there. And I have gone to see her when they've told me, "I'm sorry, but she is not presentable and you cannot see her." And I've come back 2 months later, and she sits across the desk and talks to me just like my wife talks to me. Talks to me about the days back at the seminary, and talks to me about her husband and what's happening with her grown children and so forth and so on. So that you see there is sometimes a flexibility element. Now what we're trying to do is to distinguish between that which is normal and that which is abnormal, and particularly the person who shows marked changes in his personality, in his behavior. All right, what are some of the normal problems? That is the kinds of things that every individual faces at some time or other in life. Well, let me share 8 or 10 with you as time allows. And I wish I could take more time to discuss them. Some of them we will be back to on a later evening. But let me show you the kinds of things you're going to face. Number one, the problem of motivation. That's the person who cannot get off the dime, who's filled with tremendously good intentions. "Man, I really want to be a good wife.
but
she can't make decisive action. Well, I know I should get into the word, but. Number two, the problem of decision making. And this is the type of individual who's constantly filled with anxiety. They got five different decisions to make, and they can't make them. They have a hard time deciding what dress they're going to put on today. Nobody here ever had that problem. You know, it never ceases to amaze me to watch a woman standing in front of a closet, you know, loaded with dresses, and say, "I don't have a thing to wear." But you know, the agonizing decisions, and we laugh about it, but there are many women, and there are many men, for that matter, who get absolutely sick. I think of a man, an architect in this community, who cannot make a decision concerning what tie to wear, what clothes to wear, so every day he gets up, his wife's got the whole thing laid out, and he does nothing except put it on. And I keep kidding her and telling her, "Why don't you, you know, put on something garish someday? Just for fun, see what'll happen." And she can't screw up enough courage to do it. And remember, each of us has problems in these areas. But the question is whether it becomes a pattern in your life. And when it does, then you need help. Third, the need for encouragement. Nobody here with that problem, so let's move on. This is often the person who has lost hope. And they can make it, but they need somebody to come along and throw their arms around them and say, "I'm praying for you," or "Let me help you." Fourth, the problem of pressure. Now, there are two kinds of pressure. There is normal pressure, and there is the pressure that you create by your inefficiency, by your trying to do too much, by all kinds of hassle. And one pressure you can never eliminate. That's the pressure of life. And there are many people in our mental institution and many people who are very sick in our society because they cannot handle the normal pressures of life. And the moment they get a little pressure, they just come unglued. Fifth, inferiority feeling. Greatest problem with your husband. And speaking generally, because it's the number one counseling problem that I have to deal with here at the seminary. And I've just gotten some new insight on this. I happen to believe that this is partially true because many a young man is not only bent out of shape in terms of his role as a man, but he's also a person who is in a highly competitive society, and he has never been exposed to the kind of thing that develops self-confidence. While I was at Wheaton 2 weeks ago, I met the most fantastic group of kids, all freshmen, 120 some of them, all of whom had been on the Vanguard program, which is a program the college has developed for young men coming to college who get credit for going in this wilderness stress camping experience, where they go out in the most rugged conditions and they spend a long period of time totally by themselves in complete isolation, and they only have a minimal amount of things with which to survive. And they go down over a couple hundred foot cliff by themselves on a rope, and when that guy hits the ground, he's a new man. And the interesting thing in talking with the staff at the college is that they have had more success in terms of developing men who have confidence and who become decisive and become leaders than through any other program whatever. And I'm sold out to this. And I think any time you can encourage your husband to do something which he has threatened to do, the only thing you are basically doing is helping him to develop his self-confidence. And what most of us do is we keep standing in this little shell and we're scared to death to move out because, you know, what would happen if I fail? So they continue to fail. Six, guilt feeling. And the most common one you will get is false guilt, though obviously you will get a great deal of true guilt. Seventh, anger. Telling the students in class, I had a guy come to me not too long ago with his wife who had the biggest shiner you have ever seen. I mean about that tall, right there. Guess how it happened? He hit her. And he said to me, you know, I never knew I had this in me. And I turned to her and I said, why did he hit you? She said, because I deserved it. I said, that intrigues me. I don't run into that much honesty. She said, I provoked the living daylights out of him. See, whenever you get angry, you have to ask, did that person simply reveal it? There all the time. Well, what would it take to really make you angry? I mean to the place where you totally lose control of yourself. And you find a lot of people, and by the way, they're not all men for your information. There are more men who are clobbered in marriage. Homicide on the part of males is much higher than on the part of females. And the interesting thing, I've been out with the police, and here's a woman beating her husband to a pulp, or a woman absolutely wiping up the floor, and the officer comes in and tries to separate him, and she'll turn on him. I had to pull a woman off an officer's back one night because he was trying to keep her from beating her husband to death. Hate, anxiety, especially situational, change of job, change of location. I suspect we have a lot of that among the first-year wives. Here we are in Texas. You know, it's a new job, it's a new scene, you know. They keep making fun of my Yankee accent. Ninth, the will of God. Oh, you will spend hours with girls and with women in the subject. Let me just give you a clue. I happen to believe it's harder to get out of the will of God than most of us think, if you want it. But most people get so uptight about finding the will of God, it's unreal. And they say, look, there's more responsibility on God's part than there is on yours. The only responsibility you have on your part is to make sure you're willing to do the will of God. Do you want the will of God? Nothing more, nothing less, nothing else? Oh, yes, absolutely. Then relax. You're going to find it. And the more uptight you get, the less your possibility of finding it, and the greater your possibility of missing it. All right, now let me share with you some abnormal problems. Those needing professional help. And I'll give you a list as time allows. And one of the great needs is the need for people just like you to become sensitive to people and their problems, so that you diagnose as early as possible that this is an individual who needs professional help. They may need medical help. They may need spiritual help that I can't give. They may need a marital counselor. They may need psychiatric help. Here they are. Number one, those who refuse to eat and complain that their food is distasteful. Now, again, we're not talking about a person who comes home with a rather substantial pain in his tummy and doesn't particularly care to eat tonight. We're talking about a person who has a very normal appetite, but suddenly comes to a period of time that you cannot explain on the basis of anything situational. It isn't the fact that the guy just lost his wife. Friend, I don't expect him to eat. And that's often what happens. Everybody comes out from under the rocks to bring the lovely dishes and the rest of it, and the poor guy's, you know, so torn up with grief on the inside, just to think of food almost makes him sick. But in a few weeks, he returns to normal. And he continues to eat and discovers the world goes on pretty much like it did before his wife passed away. He has a responsibility to his own body. So we're not talking about that. See, we can explain that. This is the person who suddenly stops eating. And it lasts for a period of time. And when he does eat, nothing tastes right. Second, those who have sensations of numbness in various parts of their body. This is the person who begins to tell you that this arm is going dead and they have no feeling in it. Or there's sharp tingling sensations down here in the extremity. So this is a person that you want to get, usually, first of all, to some medical help, though they may be emotional problems. We had an interesting case here at Baylor some time ago. This was a dear woman who was totally paralyzed on this side of her body. I mean, she couldn't move it. And he gave her every test in the book, and there's absolutely no organic reason. But my friend, she can't move her arm. We call this technically psychosomatic medicine. That is, the ability to recognize when there is no organic reason, there may be a psychological reason. And the interesting thing is, in a short period of time with good therapy, to watch this dear woman going through exercises, you'd think she'd never had a bit of difficulty with her body. Third, those who have tics, T-I-C-S, this has nothing to do with what your dog has got. It says twitches of the facial muscles. It's usually a neurotic spasm that affects the face. And it will sometimes cause the face to move partially toward one direction or the other. And there's some very interesting surgery that is being perfected, which I have watched on many occasions to correct this, particularly on the part of a woman who gets a partial paralysis on one side related to a problem in the middle ear. And oftentimes the eye will twitch, and I'm not talking about what happens to you when you stay up too late some night and read too much, and you know, all of a sudden your little eye goes, you know, and you look at everybody quite convinced, man, oh, I think I'm a flirt. The truth of the matter is most people don't even notice that you have it, but you become painfully conscious of this type of thing. Fourth, those who manifest severe speech disorders or motor disturbances. That is the person who begins to talk, because they're having real problems articulating their speech in terms of their lips, teeth, tongue, etc. Fifth, and this is the one you ought to watch for, and you'll get them. Those who speak in private language, they coin words, their logic is disjointed. I had a sad experience. One of the first missionaries we ever supported in our church is a remarkable person, particularly in the technical field. He was a radio technician, probably one of the choices that Wycliffe has had. But he's one of these intense type of individuals. And they constantly kept telling him, look, you need to take a rest. Oh, you know, man, the devil doesn't take a rest, so, you know, which is fine. You're the devil. Come home, you know, on furlough and just become neurotically, compulsively active. I had to tell everybody about what's going on down in Peru, jungle camp where he was working. Here's a guy who totally shot himself out of the saddle. And I hadn't seen the guy, mind you, for a good 10 years. And I walked out of this door after chapel down the thing, and here he is standing there. And the first thing he says to me, do you know what, Hendricks? The Nicolaitans will get you. Do you know the Nicolaitans are after us? And the greatest problem with the seminary, it's really not sensitive about the Nicolaitans. And he's going on and on and on. And of course, if you've ever been in a mental institution, you know, you see these people off on the side, talking to themselves, talking to imaginary audiences. Sometimes you'll see them walking down the street, just talking away like crazy. And the amazing thing is how often it relates to religious matters. See, that's not an accident. Six, those who complain of migraine headaches or other chronic ailments. And by the way, it's very important in connection with a migraine headache. Don't minimize this. If you've never had one, you have difficulty sympathizing, but I went through a period of time when I used to have these headaches, and it was just as if somebody put an axe right down there in the middle of my head. And here you are in a class or in a preaching situation or something, and then you have a hard time even speaking logically. Jim Rayburn, who was my close personal friend, used to have the most severe migraine headaches. We used to go down to Baker Hotel, and we'd have 600, 800 kids for a banquet. Nobody could speak like Jim Rayburn to a group of kids. And some of us who were his closest friends would have him out on a bed stretched out with one of these things until finally the very last minute, and somebody would introduce him and we'd say, "Jim, you're on." And he'd walk out on that platform and go just as if nothing ever happened, walk off the platform, totally collapse. Now, this is a case in point where it's very important to get good medical help, because there happen to be two problems to migraines. One is the tendency of these blood vessels to squeeze together, and the other is the tendency of the vessel to expand. And you need two different kinds of medicine, because if you give one kind of medicine, all it will do is increase the stricture or increase the expansion. Seven, those who have delusions of grandeur, who complain that the world is against them. We call this paranoia. And this is why you have so many Napoleons, Jesus Christ, the Apostle Paul, President Lincoln. Man, all of these people are over in terror. And it's really a good thing for you sometimes, girl. This is a part of what I mentioned earlier, that you need a little reality exposure. Unfortunately, sometimes they give you sort of the front office tour of the place. What you need sometimes to get behind the scenes, and some of you gals who've worked in nursing know exactly what I'm talking about. This will make a woman out of you. And you see these dear people in this kind of condition, and talking off by themselves like crazy, and this woman is thinking that she's Clara Barton, and man, she's gonna get that flag up, tearing the sheets off the bed to put that flag up every day. And you come out of this kind of experience realizing, man, there must be another way to fly. And I'm certainly jealous that Jesus Christ will begin to operate in my life so that I won't be sucked into this kind of a problem, and every one of us sitting here is a candidate for it. So you're a person, and a person has problems. And if you don't learn to manage your problems, then the extremes continue to build up. Those who report hearing strange voices, they feel designated as a messiah. We call it the messiah complex. Some other representative from God. An old boy here at the seminary a few years ago who just totally came unglued. Took about 12 of us to hold him down. And he was quite convinced that he had solved the problem through the authorship of Hebrews. In fact, I guess I was the last guy that got him. He had been to a number of others and walked in my office. It was over in this other building. He'd been up all night long. Near white, mind you, climbing the wall trying to figure out what in the world. He didn't even know there was a problem. And this guy finally got the solution, and boy, he's coming in my office, he's prompt, I got it, I'm working, and finally got the answer. We had another student who had a similar situation called his father, who was a very astute, perceptive pastor, and this is the kind of thing that you pick up through experience. Called his father to tell him that he had finally discovered who the Antichrist was, and then he had the whole picture, and his father very calmly says, "Son, that's tremendous. I'm glad that you shared it with me. Would you do me a favor?" "Sure, Dad, anything." "So would you mind going to see Dr. Walkie?" Or gave a few names of those of us that he knew in the faculty, and tell this to them, being sharp enough to know that when the kid walked into the office, somebody would get him
to the place where he could get some help. Ninth, those who are disoriented as to time, as to place, as to person. And the hardest things to relate to is the person who completely loses his sense of who he is, or where he is, or what's going on. We had a student who became so disoriented with respect to time and place and person, and of course we notified his parents, wonderful people up in the north, and he was engaged to a girl. And so I was assigned the task of picking up the family and his fiancée and bringing them over to the seminary, and I knew that my first responsibility was to let them know what they were going to face. And so very gradually, driving out of left field, I'm beginning to fill them in on how they can help in this kind of a situation and what you may expect. Well, man, was that ever providential. And I particularly told this girl that there's a possibility that he may not recognize you, so I want you to know this when it happens so it doesn't jar you. And the dear gal and I prayed before we got out of the car, as well as the parents, and sure enough, we walked in and he took one look at this girl whom he loved so dearly and said, am I supposed to know you? What is your name? And this very lovely girl turned to him and said, sweetheart, Mary, and I love you. And threw her arms around him. Now, the interesting thing is, this man is in the ministry, has a remarkable ministry, functions perfectly normal. I'll tell you why. That was the process that God used to stab this guy awake, that he had to learn how to manage pressure. And when he got certain symptoms that the pressure was beginning to build up, he was going to have to take off and sit down and relax. And the result is he does a beautiful job. He just paces himself with no recurrence. Tenth, those who are confused as to their own identity. 11th, those who are pronounced alcoholics, or who have a practice of uncontrolled homosexuality. Pronounced alcoholics, uncontrolled homosexuality. Those who are bedwetter, and enuresis is the technical term. And we're not talking about your little kite, you know, that's got a loose connection. It's still in the process, you know, of learning how to get it all together. That's perfectly normal. It's a good illustration of normalcy of problems. I mean, don't run to your doctor or anybody else. You know, we get very few students who come here who haven't solved that problem. So, you know, relax. When I'm talking about the kid, you see, who used to come to Word of Life camp, to our high school camp, and would wet his bed because of the tremendous pressure of being in a totally new group and situation. Maybe he was shotgunned into going by some parents who thought, man, this will solve this problem. And preparing counselors so they're sharp enough to know how to strip that bed down as fast as anything and get new sheets on it, so that nobody else knows about it, because that's the great problem. That great pressure to find out the night. So he'll lie, he'll cheat, he'll do everything in the world to cover for this type of thing. Those who have extremes of emotional responses. We're talking about great highs and lows. This is the person who laughs at the funeral and who cries at the most joyful experience. And I'm not talking about tears of joy. I'm talking about a person who just breaks out convulsively sobbing. Those who have no sense of right or wrong. And by the way, that's something you need to become sensitive to with respect to children as they're growing up. And I'm not talking about the kid who cheats or who lies, and who knows perfectly well what he's doing. I'm talking about the kid who's fast developing the pattern in which he cannot tell what is right and what is wrong. He's so confused in his mind. Those who have convulsions or go into a deep form of sleep. By the way, girls, this is one that you get a great deal among girls, and particularly, I would say, during those traumatic years when a girl's period is beginning to develop and perhaps she has other problems, and all this does is serve to trigger this type of thing. We discovered we used to get a lot of this in camping. And I had a girl who was on the staff at Word of Life, and we used to have a rodeo. So, man, she rode those horses till she was, you know, coming out of her skin, and got into the car. I was sitting in the back seat. She was sitting in the middle with another guy over, and, boy, the moment she got in the car, she went over. Well, you know, most women do this to me. So, boy, she was shot. So we get up to the place where we're going to take the boat across to the island, and she's still out. And so a couple of the guys picked her up and put her in the speedboat, and all the way over, we're taking cold water out of the lake, pouring it over her face, but no response. We get to the other island, I said, you call the doctor and tell him he'll be over in the next boat to meet us there. Because you see, this is a form of narcolepsy, in which if you do not jar them out of the sleep medically, they will continue to go into it so deeply that eventually they will expire. So if you cannot awaken a person, this is not a minor matter. This, you need help. And then last, those who are deeply depressed and toy with the idea of suicide. I'm going to give you a real important clue, girl. There is an idiocy with respect to suicide. And that is, the average person says that a suicide will not tell you what they are going to do. If they talk about it, they won't do it. Don't ever believe it. 96.7% of the people who commit suicide tell you not only what they are going to do, but precisely how they are going to do it. So when a person talks to you about this, do not view it lightly. This is a person who needs help and a lot of support. So do not ignore it. In most cases, a suicide is basically a scream for help. And this is why so many of them never really do the job. You want to take your life, it's the simplest thing in all of the world. You'll never miss. But this is why they slice their wrist, which is a very poor way. Because they don't want to go. But they want to dramatize their hurting. And this is why some people will do this 6-7 times. Or they'll take an overdose of sleeping pills, but the interesting thing is, they never take enough. Just enough to put them out. My daughter had a roommate some time ago, and this girl, I would say 20 times in the course of 2 years of living with her, attempted to take her life. But it was always, you know, just there. But never quite enough. A real plea on the inside for help. Now, my time is up. In fact, over, but I wanted you to know these because I think that this will be of great help to you in the process of the ministry to which the Lord is calling you. And I am much in prayer that God will make you girls very sensitive, because believe me, you are living in a very sick society. And you will have a lot of exposure to this type of thing. And to be able to recognize it and seek help for it is the most contributory thing you can do. Our Father, we thank you that we are related to you because you are the infinite person. And you not only work in us, but you work in the life of those we seek to help. We thank you that you're able to do exceeding abundantly above that which we ask or even think, according to the power that worketh within us. And we do praise you for the discerning ministry of the Holy Spirit, and for the wonderful way in which he delights to use human instruments. And we pray that you will continue to make us people who are responsive to you and responsive to people in their need. Thank you, our Father, for the privilege of this hour and that which is to come. In Christ's name, amen.